and welcome to No Direction. I'm Esther.
And I'm Navar.
And today, do we have a long-awaited episode for both of us, and I'm sure for y'all.
Yeah, that's fanfare in the background, clapping, screaming.
We are going to be talking about the Tian Xia World Guide today, our first of probably several episodes on this book, this area of Galarian. Before we dive in, we did have a few things to start us out with at the top of the episode. Yeah, the first thing I wanted to start with is I promised y'all that I would give you an update once I ran my kineticist character. And the update is, it happened. It was so much fun playing a kineticist. He rolled terribly against my party the entire time. I set them up for a severe encounter. They wiped the floor with their opponents. It was honestly a really, really satisfying moment for them. But also, like, even when he was wiping the floor with himself, my kineticist, he was a really cool character. Like, I had so much fun and highly recommend it. Elemental Blast is awesome. If you have the feat, I think, Lightning Dash, also awesome. So I just, yeah, I recommend that. And yeah, then I wanted to briefly mention that we finally found out which god is gonna die, and it was revealed to be Gorum. Navar, thoughts, feelings, reactions?
Yeah, Gorum is the moon god, right? The one of Manus?
The war.
That's the war. Oh, the war. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, I'm thinking of Gusra. Right? No, that's
Grotus?
Grotus. Excuse me. Yes. Yes, Gorum. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? God of War, you're gonna be get in trouble. I do think, yeah, it's fun. I had to stop tracking it constantly because I was like, this is too much for me personally to like, will they, won't they? Who are they gonna kill? But I am glad that it wasn't Desna personally. But yeah, it is fun. It's a fun, I'm glad that they, I think the biggest thing for me is I'm glad that Paizo got to have so much fun with this specific thing for so long. I think that's brings me joy. So
yeah, same. And then before we get into the Tian Xia World Guide, we wanted to like briefly acknowledge that there has been some controversy in the wake of this book's publication. Personally, I think that's really unfortunate. And it's one of the controversies was written about on the site Rascal News and kind of got some traction. So we felt like we should at least mention that we've seen it on the show. Yeah, for me personally, I think what I have to say is just, first of all, it's never cool to harass an author, even if you don't like or approve of what they've written. Not cool. I'm really disappointed in the folks who have engaged in some of that behavior. And from what I have gathered of some of the rest of the controversy, I think I'm just a little disappointed that it got very quickly into, I don't really want politics or social justice in my game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think y'all know Navar and I well enough by now to know that we're really about those things. And so seeing some backlash was, quite frankly, just disappointing for me as a Pathfinder fan. That's what I wanted to say on the show.
Yeah. I mean, it's so bizarre. There's been not only with Joseph Paizo, but like in recent history, like within the past 6 months to a year, there have been multiple things that have been like, this has been this way for a long time. And for some reason in 2024, people are just forgetting that and having weird reactions to it, which is unfortunate and absurd mostly. But yeah, Pathfinder, especially Pathfinder second edition, I think has done so much work to be political in the best way possible of in terms of inclusion, diversity, making sure that, you know, things are written from people's own cultures. Even the Pathfinder society in itself, like when that was one of the things I remember thinking, looking at quickly when I was reading the Moenge Expanse book, and it's like, yeah, they're not going out and treasure hunting and taking things from places. Like, it's about preservation of these people's cultures. And so it is really unfortunate. Like, this to me, this book is another huge achievement for Paizo and for all of these incredible authors who contributed to it. And I know the feeling of like seeing something that's written for people that represent parts of you, and this should just be celebrated. So yeah, it's very frustrating that some people decide to take it to a place I should never been taken to. I unfortunately I'm not surprised because this is an aspect of the fan space that we live in, unfortunately. But I would have liked to been surprised in the other way of just, you know what? Hey, everybody enjoyed this and wasn't weird about it. So yeah, I think it's an incredible achievement. It's incredible for these authors to have taken something that was already sort of predetermined in the past in some cases and make it work in a way that feels good for the people that it's representing and feels good for people who are just reading it and aren't going to be weird about it. And so, yeah, I think especially when you're having to write something that isn't just flipping it on its head and just making it only a, you know, everything here is good and nothing bad happens, et cetera, like we're dealing with these places that, you know, still have imperialism, still some places have still colonialism, some places still have all these other things. And that's a part of the world that we're playing in, but it's also how do we do this in a way that makes us feel good? I think the authors killed it. They absolutely did an incredible job. And so, yeah, mostly I'm just very frustrated with the specific amount of people who call themselves Pathfinder fans that decided to make this a bad thing.
Agreed. Agreed on all counts. And I think we really want to focus on like the celebratory aspects of everything this
Absolutely.
book has achieved, of the incredible work all the authors and designers have done. So let's get into that. I guess I wanted to ask you, like, kind of to start out, what was your associations with Tian Xia going into this book? Like, did you have experience traveling there in Galarian in games, like reading about anything? Like, yeah, what was your like stuff going in?
No, for me it was like when I got when I first got my the first book before they did the remaster, just reading it and like going through the GM section and seeing that Tian Cha was there and like sort of like as you know, as a first time reader of it, going through not only the locations and their descriptions, but also the pictures associated with each of those groups and societies and seeing like, oh, okay, yeah, this is clearly the Asian analog. And trying to see like how really just looking at it that way and seeing like, okay, this exists. You know, there's not a lot of information here about it. It's a way that somebody who is Asian could play his character, but there's not a ton. So it was like one of those things where it's like, we've talked about this before. Getting the Moenge Expanse for me was like, this is incredible. I want more people to have this thing. And so just like I asked Luis about when we would get like Latine cultures represented in a setting book. Tian Cha in my brain was like, this is going to be the next one. I was wrong in that prediction, obviously. Impossible Lands came after that. But it was something that I was like, this makes sense that it would come. And I know that some of the delays that happened weren't just because of them not wanting to do it yet. It was other, the OGL was a big one and the remaster and everything else. So, but yeah, so I think like that was a huge thing for me. But I just knowing that it was finally coming and seeing that first announcement, I was like, ah, oh, yes, this is great. But it's the same. Like, I think that's the thing. I love making homebrew worlds. Galarian is a lot of fun for me to play in. And so having this stuff that's written as well as it's written and knowing like I can now have this stuff fleshed out in a way that is going to make it easier for me as a GM to play in. I really, really love that.
I love that too. I have to say, I'm similar to you. I had read, the information that was available in the 2E guides. Before that, my primary kind of exposure to Tian Sha was playing 1E. I have a good friend who's white, like not completely into like politics, social justice, like consciousness, that kind of thing. But we were talking about places in Galarian, and somehow Tian Sha came up, and he was like, yeah. They do have like a Galarian equivalent of Asia. I'm really uncomfortable going there because of the way it's written, and like I don't want to do anything offensive or like problematic or like hurt someone in doing that. And so it feels kind of weird because like I want to have this representation in my games, but the way it's written, I'm really uncomfortable with. And I was like, oh, if you're uncomfortable, what's it gonna be? So when this book was announced, I was really, really just so excited to find out what all these talented, amazing, thoughtful, caring authors did. And let's get into it.
I mean, like just generally about the book, I know we kind of touched on a little bit. What was like your sort of general like intake of this of the world guide itself?
I honestly think there's so much on basically the first page, which is page five, where they have this like beautifully written, approach to Tian Xia can't be summed up in a single book. Your characters are people first, and then their culture comes in. Here's how to be thoughtful about this. And then this like five tips for Tian Xia that instantly I was like, oh, I just love this. And I think two of the biggest things were dragons aren't monsters. We're gonna talk a lot about the dragons, I think. And so they really stood out to me as glorious, unique, like distinct from other dragons we've met in Galarian thus far, and then like spirits being everywhere, and the dead not necessarily like going straight into the river of souls into Pharazma, like the dead lingering ancestors being like present. That was really also with me throughout reading this book, and I thought that was all beautifully presented just right up front in the beginning.
I agree. Yeah, that was the first thing that really stuck out in my mind. And then as I continued to read it, I was like, okay, there's a common sort of theme here, which I think I want to talk, like, spend some time talking about. But like, the one of the biggest things for me that I really loved is this idea. We already live in a Galarian's already a world where there are multiple gods who are, like, in the reality of Galarian, factually existent and true, and who all have these different domains and different areas of concern, and some of them different live in different realms, et cetera, et cetera. And what's fascinating is that there are that that exists, and that in different places culturally, that still exists, but it's separate from what is happening here. And I think I really just love that idea of, like, just because that we all share sort of a pantheon, even if we're not all, like, praying to the same gods or being devoted to the same gods specifically, they all still exist in our world. We here have a different cultural existence when it comes to this sort of thing. And our cultural existence when it comes to these gods and these legends and myths affects how that works where we live. And I just love that. I like the idea of, like, we'll talk about it more, but like the Imperial Dragons being like, yeah,
Yes.
this dragon is a god, and its back, the spines on its back are the waves that crush boats. And it's like, that's a myth and a legend, but also it probably was true at some points. The one that lives in the forest is like, it has, like, covered in moss, and it's like its body is like the hills and all this different. And it's like, is the dragon that big? Who knows? But also, it probably has done this before. And I love the way that it's tied in, where it's like these things that we talk about in a way that are legendary or mythical also exist in real time for us and affect our populace and our culture in very tangible ways. And sometimes that is hyperbole, and sometimes that's just the fact. And we blend it together in a way that makes it feel just, I mean, magical, I guess is the best word I can think of. And that was, to me, like, that was like, okay, because literally, like, to have, like, this is the canon, this is where people go where they die, except for here. Here they don't. Hear this, they stay until, because we need them, and I mean, we obviously love all the ways that dragons have been changed for the better, but furthering that into what they did in Tiantra's been amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible.
Was that something that, like, stuck out to you too? Do you feel like that was something like, oh, like, maybe, I don't know if you were drawing the same words, whatever, but, like, yeah, how did you sort of take that in as you were reading through it?
I think a similar theme for me was hearing or reading that the bodies of Imperial dragons become the land of Tian Xia. And that being kind of woven throughout this story of like this mountain range used to be like the back of this dragon, and the fact that dragons, like the underworld dragons, moving and like being active underground makes volcanoes erupt, just everything being so interconnected really stood out to me. And like the presence of spirits of different kinds and their relationship with the dragons and then their relationship with the other peoples of Tian Xia, like it's all just very, very interconnected and alive and vibrant were words that kept coming to me as I was reading this. Just like, wow, I am amazed at this world building. And yes, and amazed at the ways they have like furthered dragons being cool in this world. I love that, like, some of them seem to be basically immortal.
I was gonna say the same thing. Yeah, like they just don't die. They're ancient and they have been around since forever. I think the one that's in the deity section, I forget what her name is, but yeah, it's just like part of like the creation myth, I think, if I'm remembering how I read it.
Yes.
Or like, and then like they just want to be, they're just like, you know what, I'm just gonna rule here, so I will have no successor because I am the ruler for the rest of my immortal life.
Shizuru is the name of the dragon, yeah.
Thank you. Like that to me, like that was another thing where it's like having a lifespan, I guess, makes sense, but like after a certain point, it's like just be immortal.
Yeah.
You know, at 600 years, does it even matter anymore? Just be immortal.
We'll circle back around to that later and talking about feats, I think, or rituals, rituals, not feats. Yeah.
But I love that idea of like it's not about like you're a 1,000-year-old dragon. Like you just, you're part of how this land was made, and you continue to be a part of how this land exists. And I think that is, that was like the main, one of the main things that really just stuck out to me. And then of course paired with the incredible artwork that goes along with it. Yeah, but let's talk a little bit more about these dragons though.
So there's five kinds.
Yes, Imperial dragons, which is just another type of dragon that we have added into the mix, which I'm here for. But yeah, what's fascinating with these ones really is a lot of them are interested in governing the people that exist in their world, and they're not shy about it.
So there's forest dragons, sea dragons, sky dragons, sovereign dragons, and underworld dragons. And you get a little bit of a different flavor for each one. Like the beautiful forest dragon Arendam of the Valashamai jungle. Like, oh my God, the illustrations, the descriptions of like these extinct otherwise than on their body flowers and plants. Like incredible. Luangfeng of Xidao, this amazing ancient like mama dragon whose child has been like accidentally poached by humans and she is grief-stricken and there's like an eternal storm now. It's amazing. And then we really get into the ones who are a bit more interested in meddling in the affairs of Tian Xia. And the backstory, I think, is that this goddess dragon Shizuru had this vision that like the land was going to be in great peril. And she essentially tells the imperial dragons who were kind of doing their thing, hey, humans are going to come here and they're going to be the ones you really got to look out for to like take care of this land. And the dragons are like, okay, all right, I guess. And some of them kind of stick to that. And some of them are kind of like, but actually, I think we know better.
I misspoke a little bit. It's the sovereign dragons that are very much in that reign, but and they look at it as a divine right to
Yeah.
rule over humanity, which yeah, that's just so good. I think like just in the, you know, the little bit that I know of like some Asian cultures, like I know that there was like the Chinese emperor or things like that, like where that's, and not only just in Asia but a lot of other rulers, imperial rulers who believed that it was their divine right to rule. This is seated in history, of course. But yeah, I just love that. And it's like, well, what are you going to tell them, right? This dragon who's been around since forever, literally, and has power enough to maintain a human state forever and still use other magic. So,
Yeah,
what
what
are
are
you going
you
to
gonna
say?
tell them? The other thing I loved was this art of one of the sky dragons who is described in like the little blurb as like will rain down divine like wrath essentially on anybody who claims this throne and is unworthy. And it's been 100 years since like there was a person on the throne because this dragon just roasts anybody. And we have this amazing art of someone dying in a blast of fire sitting on this throne. It's great. Yeah.
It's bad times. Yes, and then the underworld dragons was the last one, which is such a fun, As I was reading it, I was like, oh, I can already see this. I'm already getting like scenario ideas of like how to implement this. And because they have these other little beasts, the book does have a pronunciation guide, and I will do my best as well. But I think it's Piju, and they are like these. Where's my page finder? 295. Pishio, excuse me. They're dragon-headed lions with wings, and they can smell gold, and they can tell how much gold you have on your person. But they also are used by underworld dragons to go fetch gold from places. And I just love that.
I love
Yeah, I'm like, yes, I can see the seeds of a campaign scenario sprouting in my brain as I was reading that.
One of the things I loved is I believe they write in here that, like, most Teon people's instincts when meeting a dragon is to negotiate, not fight.
Yes.
And as someone who is running a whole actual play about negotiating, not fighting, and like dragons essentially being like beings, like people. I love that that's true here. It's just the norm. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, true and intentional. And I feel like that was a big thing. To me, it felt like the change in dragons helped that a lot as well, of them not just being like, well, you're this color, so you're evil, and having it just be more about their personality and the aspects of them that sort of determine how things work. But I do love the intentionality of being like, culturally, this is how people see it. This is not something that you're just gonna like draw your sword or shoot the fireball. You're gonna try to have a conversation and get yourself out of this situation. Or if you're brave or a bad decision maker, you're gonna try to get something out of it, some kind of benefit or boon. So yeah, it's really good. I love that intentionality in the design.
Same. I also wanted to quickly shout out the pronunciation guides. Like,
Yes,
I
yeah.
was so glad to encounter a lot of them. I wish there was like a centralized location of them
I
and
agree.
that we had even more, but I'm just thrilled that we have what we have.
I look at it, I'm like, I'm just gonna assume if there's not one, then it just should be said the way that it looks. But yeah, there is a ton though. It would be nice to have them all localized as well. But I do think too, because I remember this is something that we talked to Luis about when we were doing High Helm. And yeah, I think it's so important because here's the thing that I think is going to happen eventually is that this is going to move into the actual play space, right? And even in like non-actual play space, when you're having like the organized play or just in a home game, you should be just as respectful. I think like having the ability to look at this and go, okay, now I have a better understanding of how to pronounce this, and instead of just absolutely butchering it, I think is such a good thing, which just adds more to like we're trying to do right by what's written here. So, and our Western mouths are just terrible at pronouncing words we're not used to speaking. But yes, so having that I think is a massive help. I will say just like I think because I imagine that this also comes up a lot. Obviously these places are designed after real life places and cultures. And I found myself falling into the trap of trying to figure out which place corresponded to which place. And I just, after some point, I was like, I don't think I should bother doing this anymore. Because obviously it's not like one for one in most cases. And I don't think it really matters that much personally. I think it's important that they come from that the people who are like representing this specific aspect of it are writing from that place. I do think that's important. Don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is that this is also a, these are also fictional locations. And so how much of that is the same and how much of that is different, I don't think is as important as the content of the work. But I just want to point that out. I am also fallible in that way. I was like, can I figure out which one of these places is Japan? But it doesn't matter outside of mattering who wrote it and them finding the right people to write that.
Yeah, and I guess I would add, I think it can be really cool, if you come from one or more of these cultures to like trace elements of that culture in all these different places. And maybe some are more like centralized in different Tian Sha countries than others. And like that's really cool. I think it's cool as like a student or like someone who's learning about a different culture to kind of also trace that. It's when you get into this nitty-gritty, like which country is Japan? Which country is Thailand? That I think we get into trouble there. And
Especially like
so,
a person, I'm not Asian at all,
yeah.
and I don't know that much about any other place, so it really like you can easily fall into a trap of like trying to pick out stereotypes, which I think is like something we should avoid, which is also a big reason I think it's going to be so important for us to try to bring on a lot of the authors of this to really get their perspective on this stuff, much like we did with Impossible Lands. Yeah, I don't want us to just sort of fall into that trap of like trying to talk about it in a way that just would fail at what we're
That we
trying
don't
to
have the
accomplish.
range.
Yeah, because we really want to, this is an achievement. And it's a wonderful thing that we want to celebrate. So, but yeah, all that said, the fact that there are so many places and the fact that they're all so just, well written and well developed and, distinct, I think it's just been it's so fun to read through this and just get different ideas of what these locations are like. Because especially like, having the ability as the GM to bring your people to different, to bring your players to different places in Galarian, I think it was a lot of fun.
So
So,
much fun.
yeah.
Yeah. And I will say, reading through this book, I felt like there can be this delicate dance of wanting to represent cultures, elements of cultures well in a fantasy world and make and help people feel like belonging and help people feel seen, and also wanting to do that well and not mess it up or not hurt someone in the process. And I think it takes a really careful world building process and writing process to create a whole book where you are offering it to folks who may be familiar with a lot of elements of these cultures and to people who have no idea and want to come in and run something. And I felt like I could do that and not mess it up, just given the material here. Like I could be comfortable playing in this part of the world and not feel like I'm gonna hurt someone because of the way the material is written or because of like the lack of guidelines or something. I just think they've done a beautiful job presenting all this, and I want to thank the team for that. I think that's so important, truly, just so important.
And I think too, like, what's cool is that we have all of that and we are able to look at it that way and see it. And there's still a character guide coming,
And there's still a
which is
character
going to
guide.
make it even easier for GMs and players to be able to do that. So yeah, I love that. Yeah, let's see. Should we talk about some gods?
Yeah, let's talk about some gods.
So the first one, this is just, it was something that I was funny as I was like kind of skimming through stuff, and I was like, so Heifan, who is like a Tengu
Yes.
god, and it like as I was skimming through, I was like, oh, okay, and oh, he's got a wife, and then you go to the to his wife's page, and she's like, yeah, she left him. She got tired of doing the thing that he wanted to do, so she's doing her own thing. I love that. Good for you.
I'm counting. So I was trying to pick like one or two gods that were my favorites. And
Yeah.
I wrote down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10 gods that I was like, oh, they're so cool.
Yeah.
So we mentioned Heifeng and Lady Jingxi, his wife. So I also want to shout out Lady Nanbiol, who is this dragon, I believe, who like fell in love with a non-dragon and kept getting like jilted and having these terrible experiences until she like became a goddess who is all about complicated feelings of betrayal and grief and pain. And I loved her. I thought she was so cool. I loved Lao Shu Po, the old this rat goddess who was literally a rat who was like, I am getting divinity. I thought she was incredible, like, and I think is kind of over thieves and like opportunities and stuff like that. Just a startlingly amazing range of gods have been written here, and I can't say enough about them all. Just incredible.
Yeah, I love P. Deva, who's just like a collection of birds in this beautiful silhouette. It's so like th this. I don't know where a lot of these are pulled from. Like, there's, I think the easy one, Sun Wukong, is like the one that we're all like, oh, yep, that's so easily identifiable for a lot of people. And I'm glad it's written here. Shout out to Daniel Kwan. But I do think, yeah, there's just the range of these where I'm like, I've just never seen anything like this. And I think it's just amazing. I love
Yeah,
it.
P. Deva being like this thousand nameless faces and thousand nameless voices, like
Yes.
collective of being spirit, like just a collective God. Oh, I loved it. I was, oh, amazing.
Yes. Yeah, Shizuru. Also, this was another point where I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is getting more into that thing I was talking about. Is just the ruler of heaven, which again goes back to that idea that I was talking about of like, as people who have been reading Pathfinder or Pathfinder 2E for a long time, like that's not at least in my recollection, that's not something that we see often in terms of like the divine hierarchy, right? But Shizuru is the ruler of heaven. It says right here. So, like, again, it's like this idea of like having multiple gods and deities, and also being having like these different existences be true in multiple places and different outlooks of how that works and everything else. I think is I'm really fascinated by that idea of a world that can exist in this way that like two things can be true, or different perspectives can make sense for different people and still actively be true for how the people that believe in it are affected in the world. And I enjoy that.
It's like this dynamic tension that's positive and adds so much to the world building. I also just have to say on the Queen of Heaven, they also talk about like the court and what happens when you ascend to being a god in Tian Sha, which is you essentially get like a couple centuries worth of homework, which some people love, some people don't, but there's a whole process to like how you find your place in the court and like a process to how you get inducted. And I just loved that, as opposed to
Yeah.
like kind of my impression has always been if you win the test of the Starstone, you just become a god and you just
Yeah.
get to do whatever. And I was like, oh, I'm so into there being a process here. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I think somebody should make Shuzuru go find Cade and Kaylin and have a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the mythology, I don't want to spoil like too much, but the
Yeah.
mythology of Shizuru and her lover and the jealous like half brother, I think, is so rich and rewarding. There's Daikitsu and then Nalinivati, who have these two goddesses who have like a deep platonic friendship, and their worshippers will, I think Daikitsu's worshippers at least, will like leave these beautiful embroidered offerings. I think it was embroidered at Nalinivati's altars. I hope I'm getting that pairing right. It was just, I loved reading about this idea that you're not locked into worshiping one god or believing one thing, because I think that's so true for like so many people in our world. And
Yeah.
in a world where you know for real multiple gods exist, why wouldn't it be that way? It makes
Yeah.
so much sense to me. And I love the way that has been written in here.
Yeah, because they talk about like a lot of people have like a polytheistic outlook on it. And then they kind of just, pray to certain gods for certain things as they need, which I think fa is fascinating. The other thing that I found fascinating is how Desna keeps getting changed every book that she pops up in. I'm like, weren't you a white lady before? And now you're a black lady, and now you're just a moth person, which I'm fine with. I think it's just fun too. That's another thing of just like culturally how she is seen is different in different places. But I do find it great that it's always Desna who changes
I
these
love
books.
that. They also give us several philosophies that folks follow, in addition to like a pantheon, and in addition to recognizing that like ancestors are also a part of spirituality and spiritual life in Tianxia, and like making ancestor offerings is a thing. Yeah, there's several philosophies. The one that really drew me was the Path of Mysteries, which kind of you kind of recognize how small you are in the grand scheme of things, and it can take you down two different paths, the Path of the Valley, and these folks kind of like live life to the fullest, just knowing that like death may be around the corner, and after that not much may happen, but right now you just live life to the fullest and go where life takes you. And then the Path of the Summit, which is essentially like immortality should be your goal, and you do everything you can to embrace and like achieve that. I just thought this was really juicy and really interesting. I could see multiple like plot hooks or character hooks in both of those. Yeah, I thought that was super cool.
These are really awesome. The Way of Spirits is another one that really stuck out to me. Of just like ha everything having spirit, and even stuff that's inanimate, and being able to, or being able to achieve spirit. I really love that too, because so in recently in a show that I did on Secret Podcast, I had one of my players is Korean, and her character looked at like God that way, like it in that all things contained God in some way, and that makes me think of this, and so it's really reminiscent for me in that way. But I do think, like, I just love this different outlook, this different philosophy on how things are approached, because having that philosophy changes the way that you going through all of the life and all of the things that you encounter. So yeah, it's a fun, I think, like if we're just talking like building characters and using philosophy as like a grounding point of how your character is built, I think there's things here that can really help to sort of like navigate how your character moves through the world. And I think that's a lot of fun.
Totally. I wanted to briefly mention on the topic of immortality. There's some really cool rituals in this book after the philosophies section. And a lot of them essentially give you a cool feat or something. But the very first one, which is a level 10 ritual, is called Perfection of Essence. And it essentially makes you immortal. If you succeed, you've purified your body enough to attempt to attain immortality, and once you have like withstood effects of poison for a little while, you don't age unless you wish to. You can't die except due to old age, and if your dying or doomed condition would increase to a high enough value to kill you, it doesn't increase, and any effect that would instantly kill you instead just reduces you to 0 hit points. If you ever truly die and aren't returned to life within 1 year, you may descend from the heavens as an adult into a new mortal body somewhere in the world. Yeah. I thought that was so cool. I am so into this. Yeah.
It's a high DC,
It's a high
but is
DC.
it worth it?
Yeah. Just I've always wondered in magical universes like this, especially where like some beings are immortal and other beings have attained a path to immortality. It's always weird to me when characters kind of aren't allowed to go there. And so I love that this is just very explicitly giving folks a path to that if they're interested.
Because because I was gonna say, well, Leshies aren't immortal. They just don't age, right? They're immortal
I
in the
think
sense that
so.
like you can't die of old age as a Leshy. You're just live forever. I could be getting that ancestry wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's Leshy.
And
But
Gorons also? Because the Druid Goris created them and they can't like create more, but the ones who are around have been around for like hundreds of years, and you essentially like don't die by normal means.
But I've heard arguments one way or another of people being like, does it matter if your elf is 600 years old? Because who's going to play a campaign that long? And I am like, yeah, I guess. But also, it's just cool to be like, I've been alive for 3,000 years because I succeeded at this, at purifying my body. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
And just being able to come back, just be like, yep, I actually don't want to stay up here in heaven, so I'm just going to descend into a new body.
I think that's really cool. And I also think it's really something to like, it's an interesting perspective for a character to have. Somebody who was once mortal and has become immortal, and like, what would that be like? I'm always intrigued by playing characters with like very different lifespans than my own, because I want to get in their heads and be like, okay, if I had been alive for 300 years, what would my outlook on time be? What would my outlook on like small everyday annoyances be if I have lived that long to see things shift in this world? I think that's cool. So yeah, I'm a fan of this ritual.
Yeah, I also, I mean, the Power of the Beast ritual is pretty wild too. It starts off as to simply kill the magical beast who populate Tiansha is needless and wasteful. The gods reward a hunter who seeks to truly understand their prey, approaching the creatures on their own level and seeking to gain their strength. So if you succeed at this, you gain the Titan Usurfeet, which is like basically there's essentially these are ways that you can just get extra feats without having to like spend them in your character level ups, which I think is a lot of fun, but also like narratively interesting as well. To be like, yeah, I'm gonna take this challenge and go fight two or more, or yeah, a monster that's two or more sizes larger than me in single combat without weapons. Incredible.
Incredible. Amazing. And that's a level two ritual.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be that. I mean, I still, you gotta be careful about which animal you pick, of
Oh, yeah.
course. But yeah, just play a fighter or a monk and you'll be fine.
Yep.
I guess you could be a druid too, technically.
Oh, yeah.
No, well, because second, I don't know, depending on when you do it. Druids take a while to get cool animal changes. You could just change a part of your body and magic weapon yourself. Or have, yeah, there's ways. You could just try it. Somebody to go try it. Somebody try it and tell us about it, please.
Navarre, I love that you're like thinking very carefully about how to do this and planning it out. And my approach is always like, okay, I'm gonna go in with my fists. We're gonna
Yeah,
see how this goes. In video games and in TTRPGs, I'm
no.
often just like, okay, YOLO, and maybe
No.
this is my one life.
No. I think like we were talking about this before we started recording, but for me, a big thing, like I love the process of figuring out what I need to do to beat something. And I think that they're like I have an upper limit on that. Like I don't necessarily enjoy Dark Souls games, for instance. I enjoy them to a point, but then I get bored because it's just like, okay, this is too much now. But like The Witcher, for example, is like you can just go fight somebody. You could just go YOLO this monster, or you could figure out what it is, plan for how you want to fight it, knowing that you're going to do some things to attack its weaknesses, and then track it down and then fight it that way. And I love that part of it. So yeah, to me, I'm like, okay, which monster are we choosing? Do I know if I can fight that monster? I'm gonna roll that knowledge check first. Then I'm gonna prepare for that combat. I'm gonna make sure I've got some buffs going. And then we do it and do the ritual so I can get this feat. Because if you just walk into the forest and try to fight a dinosaur, you probably are gonna die.
Probably. And my approach would be a little different in a tabletop game than a video game where I can just go back a save.
But as we know in TTRPGs, there is no save
There
point.
is no save.
So, yeah, as we kind of mentioned earlier, there are obviously so many locations. It would be impossible for us to even touch on all of them in one session. So, we want to do our best to try to bring on multiple authors to talk about this book and the character guide when it comes out. But in the meantime, just kind of touch on one for each of us that stuck out. So if you would like to go first.
I'm happy to. So I really debated whether I was gonna like pick a country at random or go to the one that I was like, I want to go here first. And I wound up doing that. I chose Jinin, which I hope I'm saying right. I couldn't actually find the pronunciation for that. But Jinin is essentially a country that was founded by elves fleeing Earthfall, and they fled into the Darklands from Avistan. And their leader, like, or an elf named Jininsiel, sees visions of a silver tree leading to safety. And then she finds these Dawn Silver Veins and leads a big contingent of elves to the country they will call Jinin, which they find like completely destroyed from Earthfall, and they're like, we need to restore and preserve this place, and essentially spend a long time doing that. As humanity begins to gather again, they realize that this forested land is kind of protected by a power, and I believe the elves make shrines from the Dawnsilver called Ayawu shrines. They wind up being protected by local humans who figure out, like, we don't need to go into the forest, but we'll stick with these shrines and take care of them. Eventually, the elves do reveal themselves, and these shrine keepers kind of stay on and start vetting other people coming to Janine and making sure that, like, they're cool. It lies above the surface and below ground. There are beautiful, like, Dawnsilver mines. They have these beautiful public meditation gardens called Lathrali. And I loved reading about this, and I wanted to go there for a couple reasons. Because I'm an elf girl. I love elves. But also, I think elves are so often represented in popular media as white. Like, not all the time, not all the time. There's a couple, like, notable exceptions. But a lot of the time, elves are just presented as, like, white people. And I got so excited for a whole country of elves that is primarily not white people, that is representing Asian identities in this world in some way. And I was really excited to read about that. So yeah, I really enjoyed reading about this country, the A Day In and A Year In. The A Day In, like, emphasized that it starts with morning exercises and folks work for a few hours and then have, like, lunch at tea houses, and when they can, really like to have afternoon meditations in these public meditation gardens. And maybe the schedule is a bit of an adjustment for newcomers, but, like, once you get it, you get it. I loved that. A Year In, they emphasize celebrating the new year, and I loved this inclusion of smashing an object that you've spent a lot of time on to, I think it was, emphasize the sacrifice of their people in their journey to Jeanine, and then wearing, like, birth necklaces that are made from the Dawn Silver at this time of year. Just thought that was super cool. I particularly loved the morning exercises. Some of our listeners may know this, that I have had the great privilege, I would say, of living in Taiwan for 2 years. And I have such fond memories of waking up every morning and going to the public park near my house and watching folks just, like, doing morning exercises together. And, like, anywhere I would go, anywhere I would travel, this was a thing. And so it just brought a lot of, like, warmth to my heart reading about that here. And I have wished that was more of a thing in the place that I live now. Wish we did that. Yeah. Any other notable things that I wrote down? I loved that their sword fighting styles are named after flowers. I loved that there are some pre-Earthfall elements of Avestani culture, including only pre-Earthfall gods, and I noticed only Alcida from the Elven Pantheon. Thought that was really cool. For them, deep earth is linked to horrors, and burial is abhorrent, so cremation is in. And they are a semi-feudal society ruled by a Kathdaran and a 12-member council called the Court of Silver Leaves. And yeah, it seems like a largely, like, peaceful place. There's a couple things going on, like a blighted dude in the north who gives them trouble sometimes, but otherwise it seems like a lovely place that is, like, a lot of history is preserved there, and they're maybe figuring out how to, like, have diplomatic relations with other folks in the region, but it seemed like it was chill overall. So that was Jeanine, and I really, really enjoyed reading about it.
And just like you are an elf girly, I just like big monsters. So I was like, hey, what's up with this Valashmai jungle? And let me tell you, it's full of kaiju and big dragons and other demons and other things like that. Which, yeah, I just find this place like being full of kaiju incredible. So the thing I found fascinating when I first picked up Pathfinder 2E was like looking. My friend wanted to play a druid. That was his first character when we played. And he, as I was like looking to see like, oh, okay, like what are the different things you can turn into? I was like, hang on, there's a kaiju option. Where do I find these kaiju? And now we know. They're just all here in the Valish Mai jungle. But I just love this idea of like these big monsters all living in this place. And it's very much like a place of like all these sort of disparate communities because the jungle is so dangerous. You can't like just, it's not easy to pass through to get to other places. So they end up having very like localized regional cultures. And they, my favorite thing about it, I think, is dinosaur season. It's so bad, apparently, that the dinosaurs are treated like locusts. Like they're just like they have so many babies around the same time that they just all are popping up, and it's like a problem. The predators are a problem. The herbivores are a problem. It's all a problem. People have to like store their food safely. They have to go out there and hunt to like cull these herds down of all these different dinosaurs. And I just think that's so funny and so fascinating. But this is also where our imperial dragon lives as well. And so just like all of that, like just being tied, I think like having fantasy worlds where the jungle is like this place that has a lot going on and is very dangerous, but also like is very culturally rich, I think is a lot of fun. And I think does, in my opinion, good for jungle culture stereotypes. So yeah, that I mine is definitely not as deep as yours was.
No.
I just like big monsters. The thing, if I have one complaint about this, it's that I can't tell in some of these pictures which are kaiju and which aren't, and I just want more kaiju pictures. So that's all. I just want to know what are the big monsters that we can see. Which one of these resembles anything from a modern Godzilla film? And how do I attack my players with it?
I
What are
love
the
that.
stats for a kaiju? That's what I'm asking.
What are the stats for a kaiju? No, I love that. I especially love like the little herds being like locusts and being pests. I'm thinking of like having to lock up your food in like a bear safe can, like camping or something, which I have never had to do because I don't camp, but I've heard stories. And I'm like picturing that, but with dinosaurs. Oh, that's
Yeah, but
delightful.
with six T-Rexes who are coming to your city walls trying to eat your livestock.
Oh, wow. That's cool. That's really cool.
But yeah, I mean, just that idea, how they manage to fit into this world of like, here are all the fun monsters that an adventuring party would want to go face one way or another. And it's in one of the most dangerous places on the planet. If you're like going out as an adventurer into this jungle to try and find these things, and a super ancient imperial dragon might also eat you if you do too many bad things. So yeah, I'm here for it. But there are like, I think it's like around 20 locations. It's an incredible amount, a huge feat, 300 page book.
Yes.
To cover it all. So,
And the countries start on page 52 of 300 something. And you also get a really, if you get the physical book, I don't remember if it's included in the PDF, but you get a beautiful big map. It's gorgeous. Like, highly recommend and love that.
Oh, you know what? We're pretty much at time, but are there any other quote unquote monsters that you want to talk about before we?
You know, monsters are the one thing I did not take as many notes on as I should. So I'm just looking through, and the art, as always, is
I know.
incredible.
Oh my God. Okay.
Favorite.
Yeah, I just remembered the one. So there, the pronunciation, I can't see it, but I think it's Gaucho Rong. They look like little bears,
Yes.
but they're not bears. And when they don't eat for a long time, their skin starts to sag off and they get real just wrinkly and they look like Shar Pei puppies. And then they will lure you in with baby sounds so they can ambush you from the trees, their friends and family, and eat you. And I absolutely need to attack my players with this at some point because
I love that.
the art is so good and the idea of it is incredible.
I do have a monster that I liked,
Yes.
or a creature that I liked. I too cannot find the exact pronunciation. I would go with Pung. It's on page 294. They are bird-like creatures, massive avian beasts who flies effortlessly among the highest clouds. The art is beautiful. It's like this gorgeous purple feathered large bird with gold plumage as well. And they just want to fly on long voyages without disruption. And a Pung's calm and steady nature is so strong that its mere presence can quell storms and still winds. Spotting a Pung is undoubtedly a sign of good luck for sailors and mariners, a feeling shared with most others lucky enough to lay eyes on these rare and beautiful creatures. And their stats are kind of about like controlling the weather and using like flight and air to maneuver if you're in combat with them, and I think that's super cool. So they're probably my favorite,
Yeah.
at least thus far. That might change because there's a lot of cool creatures in here.
Know there is. And if I'm just going to leave you all with some nightmare fuel, which is the Great Flood, which is imagine a snake, but with nine heads, basically immortal, and 40 foot tall. That's all I'm going to say because it's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
That was another thing. Like there's some pretty amazing horror monster options in here that I think would be a lot of fun to mess with.
Totally.
So great, great, great inspiration. I don't want to fight the Great Flood though.
I don't either. I don't
It's a level
either.
20 monster, so the
Oof.
odds of fighting a level 20 monster are not in anybody's favor, as it's so hard to get to level 20 anyway, unless you just
It
start there. Yeah.
is. Yeah, I think we may be leaving things roughly there for today, but we
Yeah.
will be returning to this book probably several times. We are so excited to keep talking about this book, especially with the people who helped create it, to get their perspectives and their insights. And I really want to encourage people to buy this book.
Yeah.
I think it's such a great resource. You can see the care that was poured into making this. And I just want to take a second to really, really celebrate all the people who put so much work and effort and love into this product. Like, thank you. I want to keep celebrating this for many months.
Absolutely. Yeah. We will also eventually, we're going to mix Howl of the Wind in there because we're also both excited about that one.
Howl of the Wild.
Howl of the Wild, excuse me. It's so late.
It is, and
Howl of
you've
the
done a
Wild in
lot.
there. but yes, we are definitely going to come back and try to get some authors on to talk about this. So stay tuned for that, folks.
Stay tuned for that. On that note, do you have anything to plug? Where can we find you on the internet?
Go listen to Ties That Bind on Secret Nerd Podcasts. It's a show, a 10 episode series of The Corrupted, which is the game that I designed. It's incredible. It's one of the best things I've ever made in my life. And Joe and Hamna, the cast members, were absolutely wonderful performers. So yeah, go find us wherever you pod. The Corrupted is getting an expansion as well. So check that out. Plus one EXP if you want to get the published printed version, or on my itch page, navarsnp.itch.io. You can find me at navarsnp pretty much wherever I'm online. And Secret Nerd Podcast you can find at Secret NRD Social. And I think that's it for me.
Awesome. I want to plug again Navarre's amazing series, Ties the Bind, because it really
Thank
is
you.
amazing. And I do want to say, like, sometimes you listen to something that a friend makes because you're like, I'm gonna support my friend. And I don't usually like horror. And so I went into episode one thinking, like, I'm gonna support my friend. I'm gonna make it through one episode. I was instantly hooked. I was like, this is so good. Every
Thank you.
episode release, I was on the edge of my seat waiting for the next one. I cried multiple times. It's such a good series. Y'all should
Thank you.
really go listen to it. I'm everywhere at Dungeon Minister, and my things that I make will be exhibited on my various social media accounts when I drop them. So you can follow me there. More importantly, you can follow No Direction at No Direction on Mastodon, Blue Sky, YouTube, and you can join our Discord server to chat with us about Pathfinder 2E and many other things. And I think that wraps up my little spiel. Yeah, on that
Yeah.
note, buy the Tian Sha World Guide, and we
Please.
will see you again soon.
Bye.
Bye.